Failure is not an option.
What difference at this point does it make?
Nobody said it was going to be fun.
This is Real Talk, a fearless, poignant, and intrepid show where truth speaks louder than words. This is Real Talk with your host, Audrey Russo.
The shame, not of this world, so we live on the run. We keep our eyes set, on what is to come.
It happened before. It will happen again. It's just a question of when.
Time's a luxury we don't have.
Hey, everybody. This is comedian Greg Morton, the man of many voices, cartoon voices.
Thank for the flower.
Hey, friend. You're listening to Audrey Russo on Real Talk Radio.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, this is Audrey Russo, and you're listening to Real Talk. The left's lust for socialism to be inflicted on this republic hasn't ended with their litigation of the fossil fuel industry. They are now aiming at climate deniers. And the climate kids, the human shield of the climate litigation industry, have met a bump in the road. You might be shocked to learn that it's coming from none other than the Ninth Circuit Court. Well, we're going to discuss this and more with my next guest. For my new listeners, Christopher Horner is the Executive Director of Government Accountability and Oversight, a nonprofit public interest law firm seeking to bring transparency to the actions of government at state, local, and federal levels. As an attorney in Washington, D.C., Chris has represented nonprofits like CEI, as well as scientists and members of the U.S. House and Senate on matters of environmental policy in the federal courts and the Supreme Court. He's also a New York Times bestselling author of several books, including The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming and Environmentalism, Red Hot Lies, How Global Warming Alarmists Use Threats, Fraud, and Deception to Keep You Misinformed, and his most recent, The Liberal War on Transparency, Confessions of a Freedom of Information Criminal. It's my great pleasure to give a Real Talk welcome back to Christopher Horner. Welcome back, Chris.
Thank you, Audrey.
It's great to have you back with us, starting out the new year with some great information. So we're going to jump right in. The last time we discussed the ExxonMobil case, and I understand that a group is seeking to dig into the documents that pertain to the New York AG and a man by the name of Matt Pawa. Would you share about this for us?
Yes. So as we've discussed, this campaign by a few attorneys general to investigate and prosecute private entities and subpoena even the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a group I was with for 20 years, for a decade's worth of documents because we all stood in the way of the climate agenda, actually came from a plaintiff's tort lawyer who had been suing oil companies without success for years. And in, I think, 2012 had published a report with other activists seeking, quote, a single sympathetic attorney general to begin subpoenaing the targets of his litigation, tort litigation campaign. Mm-hmm. And one attorney general came after CEI and 100 others and went fleeing as soon as CEI fought back. It was quite something because it was so thoroughly abusive. But these AGs, which got together, and you remember they had a press conference in New York with an investor, Al Gore, and they promised to use whatever means necessary through their law enforcement offices to go after opponents of this agenda and to bring the agenda about. We have a democratic process. It had failed them, so it was time to use law enforcement. Well, it came about because of the tort lawyer recruiting them, and we thoroughly documented through open records what I'll call FOIA. Though they've got different, these laws have different names in different states, FOIL in New York, through FOIA and FOIL suits, we unearthed the recruiting by this individual of these AGs. And again, we think this is just extraordinarily abusive. If you were to substitute any non-fashionable cause, this would be, Pulitzers would rain from the sky.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's very difficult to conceive that this actually came about this way, but it did. So we've documented this guy giving a slideshow, asking AGs to go after his target in California, the Attorney General, Illinois, Maryland, Massachusetts. An Illinois email said, we think Pawa's a donor, a major Democratic Party donor said, I'd like to bring in Matt Pawa to pitch the AG on joining the suit. I think he's the one who brought it to the New York AG. So during the course of the New York Attorney General's prosecution of ExxonMobil, the AG fought to seal certain records that the company had obtained and that it found relevant to certain of its defenses and to really just how this all came about. And the company, ExxonMobil, raised its own arguments why these should not be sealed. The Attorney General said, well, in essence, the court said, well, we're not going to proceed with those defenses, so I'm just going to keep these sealed. All right, well, fast forward to the end of the trial.
Yeah.
There's a transparency group called Energy Policy Advocates, which I and others represent in open records cases through Government Accountability and Oversight, and or GAO. So GAO filed a motion to intervene in this case right as it was going final. It's okay even if it did go final, but this judge will now hear it. And we asked for these records to be unsealed. And here's why. Mm-hmm. So the company made its own arguments about its own approach, which involved its defenses. We're approaching just like the press does. In fact, one of the plaintiffs, Rob Schilling, is a radio host and internet journalist. And Mr. Schilling and EPA, the group, approach this like a newspaper. In New York, the precedent involves Newsday, for example. When they want to unseal documents, judicial documents, they go through this route or another, which we're also pursuing. Because there's actually not only a common law right of the public to see judicial records, barring some specific individualized harm, which the AG is going to have to set forth and talk about in a second. The only harm is you further expose this AG and this tort lawyer for the way they're running this system, which is, as I said, just unbelievable. And there's also a First Amendment right, well-recognized First Amendment right. The common law right goes back to the old English common law. The First Amendment right obviously goes back to the Constitution. And in New York, there's a statutory right. So there are all sorts of rights to seek judicial documents unless they can specifically say, well, releasing this email with the tort lawyer recruiting us, and we can see what some of them are.
Right.
In reading the transcript of the case, you can see counsel reading some of these emails and the judge noting, well, there are 50 people in the courtroom, so some people know what these say already.
Right.
And it's this guy telling, I forget what the phrase was it go for it? investigate these people. It would help bring records out to benefit his case, obviously.
Right.
And so this is a very big deal. It's hardly controversial what we're seeking. It's very well established in New York law, and we expect a hearing, I don't know, in the next 2 months to have these unsealed. And what will be interesting is what the New York Attorney General says to try to keep this from being revealed to the public in detail. Mm-hmm. Just so you know, recently we have sued the Massachusetts Attorney General for her correspondence with this same gentleman. And she made the same claims. Oh, no, this will ruin my investigations. New York's is already ruined, by the way. The judge just humiliated them, said their witnesses were, quote, eviscerated at trial. Their case can hardly be ruined. But the Massachusetts Attorney General, who also has sued the same company, and we also know how this came about, had emails with this guy, and we sought them, and she said, it will ruin all my investigations, et cetera, and I can't. Well, we filed a lawsuit for those records. Same parties, GAO representing EPA.
Right.
And in that lawsuit, we laid out very specifically what the public record shows about this attorney general's relationship with the tort lawyer, and that she seems to have initiated an investigation and now filed suit at the request of a tort lawyer. Stop and think about that. But for the grace of God, go you. Right. Why aren't you next?
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't guns next? Why isn't life next? There is no limiting principle on the way they're using these institutions.
Sure.
And the day that, I believe it was the day her answer was due to the court, and in an answer you have to address every paragraph laid out. And we laid out in each paragraph what appeared to be this AG's relationship with the tort lawyer, and how she was using her office at his request. And rather than answer those specific allegations, they just turned over the records that they previously said would lead to dogs and cats living together, the sea is boiling and the sky is turning blood red. Now, suddenly, it was a much greater threat to answer specific allegations about her relationship with this gentleman than release records that she previously said lead to the end of, if not the world, her world. So that should tell you something. And they show yet again this the tort lawyer explaining the activists with whom he was working with to develop these cases, that he was just as a public service coming in, and he was going to show her information that had come to light to see if maybe it triggered her. And the information that had come to light that he listed happened to be three stories that we now know were arranged for and even paid for by the Rockefellers, who had originally denied this, and then they, without a headline announcing it, just changed their claim in various interviews rather than announce it. They just began talking like, we've always been at war with East Asia, Winston. And so we now know that the Rockefellers arranged for these stories, that their buddy, the tort lawyer, then carried to AG saying, have you seen these stories? Maybe you should investigate this company. It is sordid. It's abusive. It is terrifying if you're going to be at the end of it. Right now, it was a big company and an easily demonized and off-demonized company. And so it may take a little bit of the edge off as you see this unfolding. But imagine them doing this next. What's next? Who's next? There's no limiting principle to this. There's no limiting principle to what we've talked about before, this Mike Bloomberg putting privately hired prosecutors in these same offices to go after political opponents. If this is okay here, why isn't it okay for guns, life, or anything else you choose? Anything that they have deemed unfashionable can be next. So that's why we're seeking to unseal these records. We think it's very important. Certainly send a signal to the rest of these AGs. This is not how these institutions, there's likely only a political remedy. The public need to learn about this and decide if this is okay.
Sure. Yeah.
There may be ethical and legal remedies. I don't know. We'll see what they say. But this is very important, and I expect these to get unsealed this spring.
Right. Who funds PAWA, or is he independent?
Well, it's curious. He has previously boasted about a model he had been using setting up a nonprofit for charitable foundations to underwrite his work. He obviously is funded by hundreds of millions in settlements he has obtained because this is what he does.
Mm.
He works with attorneys general or states and represents them, cities, Oakland, San Francisco, I think New York. He'll file King County, Seattle. He'll get them to hire him to go after these companies with an enormous percentage, even though it does appear that this work has been underwritten by charitable foundations. He gets an enormous contingency fee if they settle or if he wins. Mm. And the reason that's notable is contingency, and really the only reason that's notable, certainly the biggest reason, contingency fees are, let's say, the lawyer stands to reap tens and tens of millions of dollars based on these agreements we've obtained.
Mm.
from the taxpayer who's supposedly damaged to the tune of X, we'll call it hundreds of millions. From that damage, however, the lawyer gets paid tens and tens of millions of dollars. Well, the rationale for this is twofold. One is there are illiquid plaintiffs in the world. There are people who can't afford a lawyer, and so the way they can is to induce a lawyer to invest in the case and then take a large percentage of the take. That's, for example, how personal injury lawyers work.
Right.
Now, San Francisco, Oakland, Manhattan are not, in fact, illiquid. They may be economic basket cases, and that is a theme running among these plaintiffs. But they're not illiquid. This is not what these agreements were intended for. However, the second rationale is, well, the lawyer has to invest in the case. But it's pretty clear, and we know for a fact, that his rival firm, to whom he keeps losing these clients, by the way, a firm out of California that is now suing on behalf of Rhode Island and a bunch of cities, including Powell's former clients. Well, we have found that they received at least one payment of, I mean, nearly $500,000 in 1 year from a charitable foundation for ocean marine conservation. Well, that's not really what plaintiffs' firms do. They file these essentially strike suits to get settlements. But it's the cynic could say, well, it looks like your investment in the case actually has been underwritten. You received an enormous amount of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars in 1 year, and I will check, but it's my understanding that this may have repeated the next year, to develop these cases. And as you may have seen, we've uncovered them going around the country, recruiting cities and states to hire them to sue energy companies for these, which just really appear to be shakedowns, but you can reach your own judgment, but they're... If the New York case is any indication, it's something of a shakedown. So it's a curious aspect of this, and I'm glad you asked, because the so-called investment they have to make doesn't appear to be the case, that it's been made for them, and their plaintiffs are hardly illiquid. They're Manhattan, San Francisco, and Oakland. So what you're doing is you're asking the taxpayer to – they're double-dipping at the taxpayer's expense if they succeed. That's something.
Wow. Well, I'm looking forward to, you don't think you have any problem with them unsealing the documents, do you?
Not if you go by the law. It's pretty clear that, I mean, they may come up with some reason why he's harmed or why the city's harmed with the public knowing how they operate, but embarrassment isn't a rationale. Their original claim was, well, he's the equivalent of a confidential informant. He's a whistleblower, New York said. He's not a whistleblower for the following reasons. We know what his presentation was called. It's called What Exxon Knew. It's not What Manpower Knew. He's not a whistleblower. He's not an informant. And second, we now got these emails from Massachusetts that they said would cause the world to end or stop spinning on its axis or so on if they released it. And it turns out that his presentation was publicly available information. Publicly available information in the form of news stories that allies had arranged for, news stories that the Rockefellers had arranged for in something called Inside Climate News, and the LA Times with like-minded writers, again, arranged for by his allies, which they then rush to the AGs and say, did you see this? And if somebody comes asking about it, you have to call me a confidential informant or a whistleblower, when in fact I'm pointing to you to stories that my allies arranged for me to bring to you and say, now, would you like to prosecute these people? Again, this is out of a John Grisham, early John Grisham book, but it's real. And again, there is, when you see the players involved and you see what they're against you. We see the Bloomberg folks, even though it's a climate group, they're also pitching the media on guns because that's one of his issues. This is climate because climate is now, and it appears to be their cash cow, and it appeared it's got full-throated media support, but so do other issues. And so if they succeed, I don't know why the other issues aren't next. The other people, your interests, you, because again, they're simply, you can't articulate a limiting principle. They're doing this because it seems to be the path of least resistance and most money. Yeah. But what's next?
What's next? Yeah, Yeah. And with especially with Bloomberg, you could see what's next. And I don't doubt it at all. I just love the way they're great at redefining things, whistleblowers. I want to jump over to the climate kids. They were given a timeout by the Ninth Circuit Court. Is that correct?
Yeah. This was something. So we discussed this once before. It was a breathtaking ask. This is a case that you saw profiled and then rerun on 60 Minutes, where you have these adorable kids who are experiencing the horrors of, or at least will, catastrophic man-made global warming, and they go to the, wait for it, Ninth Circuit to demand, and this is, you have to be seated for this, to say, once again, the political process has failed us. We need the courts to take over policymaking. Mm-hmm. Now, for those of us who were many years removed from civics class, that may be, well, yeah, that's what they're always trying to do, but think about it. And read the court's opinion, but it was an overwrought opinion, in my view, by these three judges, two of whom said, we're courts. We don't do that. I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. Remember that episode? Well, we have a legislature which, guess what, legislates. We have an executive which executes the law. And we have a judiciary which decides disputes. You're asking us to take over the legislature's job because you don't like how they've done it. That would be this would be truly the epitome of judicial activism. And the two Ninth Circuit appellate judges said, although this is a matter of national salvation, it isn't. Well, it is if you went the wrong way. I mean, this you're asking us to abandon our system, truly, a separation of powers. They were saying, out with that. I know we have separation of powers, but this is really important. And then there was another judge who said, yeah, we should take this because, and then it goes into all sorts of, this depends upon, the children's lives depend upon it and so on. These are the wages of allowing this narrative to get so out of hand, where judges, I've heard either from the bench or in other cases, including in one of the cases in New York, statements like, why don't you do science? This is about whether our children can breathe. No, it is not.
Right. Yeah.
And we have this catastrophist narrative, the Greta Thunbergism of the world and the media and some corners of the judiciary has real consequences. Fortunately, in this case, the two judges who said, we can't do this, we're a court, nonetheless said, it was more in anger than sorrow, it's a matter of national salvation, but darn that musty old document. So now this goes to the full Ninth Circuit, an en banc hearing where they're going to bring in many, many more judges from the Court of Appeals. That's an enormous Court of Appeals, so I don't imagine it will be all of them, but it'll be a large panel. Mm-hmm. And they get one more bite at that apple, and then the Supreme Court. This is a dreadfully important case for the following reason. Again, yes, we have separation of powers, but this is really important. It means we don't have separation of powers if you go along with that.
Right.
And so there was Jonathan Adler, a law professor at Case Western, who I actually used to work with many, many years ago, made the point that under the minority's argument that Lincoln should have gone to the courts. that was Abe Lincoln's because they'd take care of all that. Because it was a matter of national salvation and they'll take over. We've got this. That was a near run thing, 2-1, with the two judges saying, yes, kids, you get a timeout. I'm terribly, terribly sorry we can't do this, but we can't.
Hmm.
You just don't know. We shall find out how widespread this belief that, but we really should, extends. It's difficult when you find something so serious and you're condemning alarmism to say this without saying, really think about it. But you're talking about dispensing with our system of governance because it's really important to you.
Right.
And that makes it optional. And we've already seen that metastasize in various other, we have a treaty process for a reason. Federalist 75 said you can't put that kind of grave authority in just one man or woman.
Right.
The Senate has a role, and yet we've now said, well, it's not a treaty if we don't think the Senate will go along. At some point, you have to draw the line.
Were you surprised by the ruling?
Well, so the Ninth Circuit has a certain reputation.
Right.
So it was worrying, and I have no doubt that's one reason the Ninth Circuit was chosen as the place to try this. As you and I have discussed, we also know that it began in Oregon, and it began in Oregon for a reason. There's a professor there whose PowerPoint presentation we obtained under their open records law this last spring, and you and I talked about. It was in 2012, and the law professor was saying, we'll get this, what we'll do is we need this, what became this litigation we're talking about, the Climate Kids case, but this is back in 2012, 3 years before there was the case.
Right.
And she was writing, and then this will be accompanied by worldwide children's climate marches. I don't subscribe to many newspapers, but I believe this was accompanied by worldwide children's climate marches. This has been long in the making, very well scripted, very well planned, organized. But it was a Hail Mary. It was a real reach. And so I was concerned, and I did assume that it may come down to the Supreme Court clearing its throat and saying, at long last, Ninth Circuit, may I please get you to understand we have three branches of government and this is not our job. Fortunately, two of the three judges said that in advance. But again, now it goes to a much larger panel, and it's not a secret that circuit is a wild card. So
because it's been said that
surprised, but I could be surprised unpleasantly too.
Yeah, it's been said that Trump has ended that liberal domination of the Ninth Circuit. Is that true or
no?
Is that a dream?
I mean, the proof of the pudding will be in the rulings, I suppose. But he certainly did. You recall some of the more bitter fights were over judges who. We've got this history in the Senate of blue slips and how if a senator from California doesn't care for this judge, then the senator will withhold a blue slip. And that's been dispensed with.
Right.
But there were some very nasty, unseemly fights in the Senate over Ninth Circuit, both district court and now appellate judges. I'm not prepared to say that the president's appointments have undone what had been done through the combination of that process with Republicans like George W. Bush or George H.W. Bush and Democrats like Clinton and Obama. It is still the more radical circuit. With that said, I don't believe they sit en banc the entire circuit except in extraordinarily rare circumstances because it is so large. So I don't think you're going to get the whole circuit. You will still find a lot of judges who view things the way the dissenting judge did in this case. That's not in any way personal or a slam. It's that judge right. feels that the court should take on lawmaking because it's important. Mm. It's a view that I am fundamentally in disagreement with. I think the Constitution, there's just simply no room for that. If you read our Constitution, you have to remold it to such that it allows that. So there are some there are strikingly different views on that panel, but there are also something like a middle view, and that's the fallacy of the middle ground, where judges think, yes, this is a matter of national survival, but I think this might be a bridge too far. If you get too much of this, it's a matter of national survival, you're going to see a panel going along with this. And let me just throw in one point. What we see, for example, in state courts, there's an argument being made, well, we can go in and destroy this property or that property because global warming. That defense, the necessity defense, is from way back. You had a row houses in, let's say, old London, and there's a fire sweeping down them. You can knock down somebody's house to break the fire.
Right.
Well, that's what they're invoking here as they destroy companies' property, claiming, yeah, but global warming, and judges have been going along with it. Now, wait a minute. You are enabling a terrible thing because if you read, you don't even have to read the fine print. The climate industry is saying, not just you're destroying property, the climate industry is saying you're destroying children. So you're going to see this defense invoked for more than destruction of property. You're going to see this defense invoked because they inflicted great, maybe grave harm on someone. You're enabling very radical individuals by saying, yeah, but you've got a good excuse. So I equate the two in that, again, it's time to pump the brake, holster this, why don't you do science? This is about our children breathing business from the bench, because it isn't. And the scientific method doesn't say, well, my computer models of the future dictate, and I can get away with abandoning separation of powers because I say this really is about the fate of the earth. And you say, well, that's pretty much what I read in the LA Times. Therefore, yeah, we'll let the courts create law. That's
dangerous.
This was a nice break, but it was too close for my call. So I think that there's a lot of education that needs to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. Believe it or not, we're out of time. Important question here, Chris. Where can the listeners follow and support your excellent work and the work of government accountability and oversight and purchase your books, including Red Hot Lies and the Liberal War on Transparency? Where can they do that?
The books are available on Amazon.com, among other places. I live in a university town, so you'll have to go looking if you go to the actual store. Not everybody has my mom around to move them back to the front, as she used to do. But they're at Amazon.com, and you can follow us at govoversight.org, or we have the documents and follow the litigation at climatelitigationwatch.org.
Okay, that was great. And as always, I'll have that info and the links that Chris just shared in my after show, which is now on the live show page. Just go to AudreyRusso.com, click on the on-air button, and right under the show description, you'll find the info and the links that Chris just shared. Thanks so much, Chris, for taking the time to share your assessments with us. Will you join us again on the show? Yes.
Absolutely. Thank you, Audrey.
Awesome. Until then, may God bless you, your work, and may God save America. Bye for now.